Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. The Trump administration has rolled back many of the federal climate-forward policies. While this is a serious setback to reining in carbon emissions, efforts on the state and regional level are still moving forward. Later in the hour, we talk with Dan Wolf and Paul Nudzwicki from the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative about their ongoing work. But first, we talk with a young adult climate activist. To say Madison Shepherd is a climate activist is a bit of an understatement. She's the founder of Fridays for Future Cape Cod and founder of Cape Youth Climate Action Network. She's also an artist using different media to spread a message of conservation and appreciation of the natural world. Madison Shepherd, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We invited you here today to talk about the Global Fight for Climate Action rally tomorrow at the Bourne Bridge. But before we talk about the rally, let's start with when and why you embarked on this activism journey. Do you remember when you first learned about climate change?
I was in school, middle school. All I really knew about what climate change was just like the polar ice caps were melting. It wasn't until I was in high school that I really understood the depth of it. When I was a child, we called it global warming, but now the language has changed to climate change because it's more than just warming temperatures. You know, it's severe storms, it's the polar vortex moving downwards, it's rising sea levels. So definitely high school is when I really understood the scope of it.
So do you remember how it impacted you emotionally when you started to realize how serious this was?
It actually became a reality for me. The effects of the climate crisis actually showed up to my front door when I was living in Maine. I was living in the mountains, and we didn't usually ever get tornadoes, but one day we just got a storm with I believe it was three tornadoes in my area, and one of them formed right above my house. And so that was kind of when it really became a reality for me. And that's when it just kind of kicked me into gear, you know.
Yeah. So you mentioned you didn't really sense the reality till you were in high school. So what were some of the early things that you did as far as activism work around climate?
So I joined my high school's Planet Arts Club. We created art, we merged art and science. So we'd make like tornado simulators, hurricane simulators. We'd create like giant sculptures of like plastic sea turtles and polar bears to kind of just like, you know, like put a visual aspect to what the climate crisis is for people who kind of, you know, art is a universal language. So I feel like it made it easier for people to understand. And then I also, I remember my senior year, I went to the State House. I skipped school and I went to my first ever climate rally. We were rallying for support on the Green New Deal.
So in those early years, how did your thoughts and concerns about climate change compare to some of your peers? Were they as concerned as you were?
Some of them understood what climate change was, but none of them really had that sense of urgency that I did. And then once I found this crowd of other young people where I was through some of the organizations that I eventually ended up working with, I wasn't alone with feeling that sense of dread, but that sense of action.
Climate change and even science in general has become politicized over the past decade. And I know you can't speak for all young adults, but I wonder if young adults are less likely to view climate change as political than maybe middle-aged or older adults, given you've, you know, grown up with as part of your reality.
That's absolutely true. At least for everybody that is around me, we don't really feel a need to put politics on climate change. While a lot of climate solutions could be led back to like legislation, which is extremely important, the need for clean air, clean water, and a livable future isn't politics, it's just human rights.
It's easy to get discouraged, especially when you see advances to address climate change rolled back. How do you and your peers keep up, you know, with this energy and drive in the face of setbacks?
We do experience something that we call climate burnout or activism burnout, just basically burnout in general, where We do notice that, like it can be kind of frustrating and a little discouraging when all these rollbacks are happening. But what really keeps us going is each other. We've created such a strong network, especially with Fridays for Future. This is a one place where a bunch of youth from around the US, and then if you go even further to the global Fridays for Future, there's youth around the whole world that are all feeling the same thing as you. We kind of build each other up, we share what we're doing with our communities, and it kind of encourages us and kind of like, it helps us get more ideas and, feel like, again, feel like we're not alone. A lot of the times people don't take action because they feel alone. They don't know what to
Right.
do. So
Yeah.
that's very important.
So do you think the actions of the Trump administration could push people who might be complacent about climate change to become, more engaged? And if so, how do you plan to capitalize on this moment?
Oh, totally. I mean, we're already seeing it right now. People are taking the streets. They're upset. A lot of people are understanding that, maybe they did vote for Trump and like, maybe they did, think that they were going to get a different result out of his presidency. And now they're realizing that that was all not true. And so it's already happening. Like this big mobilization is occurring right in front of us. It's not reported in the media as much, which is very interesting. But I feel like the more people that do show up, the more that we can kind of push that pressure on our our legislators, push pressure on the president, push pressure on anybody that is in charge, and show them that we are not okay with what is happening. It's mostly pressure is what we need. We're building that resistance,
Yeah. All right. So tomorrow, Friday, April 11th, 11 a.m., the Global Fight for Climate Action rally is taking place at the Bourne Bridge. So tell us a little bit more about the rally and then the umbrella organization, Fridays for Future Cape Cod, that's organizing the event.
So the rally's happening, like you said, 11 a.m. Please just make sure to dress for the weather appropriately and bring a sign. Any sign that kind of like delivers whatever message that you would really like about the climate crisis. The climate crisis itself is such an intersectionalized thing. It could be about social justice, economic justice, whatever speaks to you. Just show up, bring your energy, and have a good time. And just to put emphasis on it, that it is a peaceful protest always. Fridays for Future, yeah, it is an umbrella organization. I believe it was started by Greta Thunberg, globally. And then we started creating groups based on like Fridays for Future India, Fridays for Future USA, and then it starts kind of going down more into like Fridays for Future New York and then Fridays for Future Brooklyn, and stuff like that. So, there's different groups depending on what community you are in. And then anybody could start depending on like what community you're in. If there's not a Fridays for Future group near you, it is very easy to start one. They've created a whole step-by-step process to be able to do that. To bring their goal is to bring climate justice or make climate justice as accessible it is and climate action as accessible as possible to any community that wants to partake.
And in regards of what's happening now with the Trump administration, are you finding more folks wanting to join the organization?
I am finding that a lot of folks are feeling that similar burnout. It's been kind of difficult to bring in more people, but there are still quite a lot of people that I'm getting that are saying like, this is awesome. We need to see more of this, but maybe they're not necessarily showing up. Maybe they're busy. Maybe they need to work. They don't have that sense of urgency anymore that we did back in like 2020. So, just under, we just need more people to understand the urgency of it, or maybe they're frozen in place, and that's totally understandable. They have that like kind of like fawn effect, like, but just showing up is what really matters right now.
Right. Madison Shepherd is the local founder of Fridays for Future Cape Cod and the Cape Cod Youth Climate Action Network. There'll be more information about both organizations and the Global Fight for Climate Action rally tomorrow at 11 at our website, capeandislands.org. Madison, thanks for being with us and for the work that you do.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Coming up after break, we talk with Paul Nizwicki and Dan Wolf about the ongoing efforts of the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative. You're listening to The Point, and we're discussing regional efforts to address climate change and promote resiliency despite the rollback of climate-forward policies on the federal level. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us now, two folks from the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative, Dan Wolf, Government Affairs Committee Chair. Hi, Dan. Good morning,
Mindy. Great to see you again.
Paul Nowicki, Nominating Committee Chair. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Mindy.
So I want to start with your thoughts about young adult climate activist Madison Shepherd, who we just heard, and all those of this next generation who are doing this work, hearing her commitment, energy, and positivity in the midst of what's happening at the federal level around climate kind of gives us hope, right? I mean, she talked about that burnout, and I think a lot of times when I always look to these younger kids because, they are the future, right? What are your thoughts?
Definitely. No, it is their future. She is inspiring and incredibly articulate. Really appreciate the way she can depoliticize the issue and really simplify it, because it really is a simple issue.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Dan?
Absolutely. I mean, she's inspirational. I do think that all of us, not just the youth, but even adults, are looking for where the appropriate place to put energy is in this current environment. I know we want to depoliticize it and see it as a non-political issue, but on the other hand, it is right now been politicized by the current federal administration. Yeah. So we got to deal with that.
All right. So for listeners who are just hearing about the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative, tell us more about the mission and the work of the organization.
Great. Thanks, Mindy. The organization was started in 2016. A group of citizens came together who were very concerned about the impacts that climate change was even having back then. And the issue has continued to evolve. We have split off two organizations, one the Faith Community Environmental Network, FCEN, and the other the Climate Action Networks, which is the town-by-town groups that are working with the town governments to implement resilience and adaptation at a town level. And the organization has continued to evolve. One of the things we've done every year is we've had an event, we've called it Net Zero, which we brought people nationally and internationally to the Cape to help educate our community and work with policymakers and civic and business leaders. So it's an organization that has continued to evolve. It's big. We have over 3,400 folks that we're not a membership organization, but we have that as sort of our network, 3,400 people. And a lot of organizations have come on board.
Mm-hmm. Offshore wind has the potential to significantly reduce the carbon emissions of the electricity we use here in the Cape and Islands. Offshore wind's been moving forward for the past decade, but where does this development stand now with everything that's going on?
I think it's basically investment in offshore wind is at a standstill right now. the president's pro-energy policies don't include offshore wind. And he likes to often talk about windmills. The projects that are permitted that are up and spinning, we hope to see move forward. But I think on the collaborative, we talked about this, and some of the offshore wind developers have been big supporters of some of the events that we've sponsored. But there have been some mistakes along the way with a new industry. When we look at the cable landings in Barnstable, for example, and something that happened there. So from the collaborative's perspective, we see this as an opportunity to look at the grid readiness issue to make sure that we're prepared for offshore wind, because it will happen at some point, and to see the state advocate for the state to play a more aggressive role, a primary role, and maybe sort of pre-permitting landing sites and taking other steps necessary to make sure that we can move as quickly to transition to renewable sources of energy when that position changes in D.C.
Mm. Are you a little bit concerned that maybe these that have gotten their permits, that it still could be, anything could happen, right? I guess we're being optimistic, right?
Yeah, the issue is really there's a market side to it, which is, do the economics work so that investors will stay engaged? Is it a predictable future? And then there's the policy, the public side of it, the government side of it. And I think, as Paul just said, the government really has to be engaged with those who are going to be building the grid, our utilities who are investor-owned. But there has to be the appropriate policies and guardrails in place so that the private entities are doing the right thing. As far as the wind developers are concerned, part of the headwind, if you will, is that the business model has become less predictable because of the policy and government environment that has sort of grown up around it, especially with this administration. So I think, as Paul said, you're seeing some of the investors pull back. relative to future plans right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would just say, you know, we're talking about a massive transformation in energy production on a national level, and it's happened pretty quickly. I mean, I hate to use that word because it should have happened a long time ago. But in this industry transformation, there are going to be lessons learned early on about how to construct wind blades and keep them safe and keep them spinning. So I think we're learning some of those lessons now, and there's an opportunity with a bit of a pause here to make sure that we get it right when go time happens.
And of course, offshore wind's not without its critics locally. Some people are, as you mentioned, not happy where cables will come ashore. Others have concerns about how turbines could impact our tourism industry.
Yep.
You're the executive director of the chamber. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, we have a long history on the Cape with that. Obviously, the Cape Wind project that was slated decades ago, really, for Nantucket Sound, there was an issue. People thought it would visually impair the view, impact tourism. Technology change, we can go deeper in the water. But that still remains an issue when we look at some of the new sites that BOEM has sited in the Atlantic in their proximity to the national seashore. I mean, that remains an issue. We don't want to see it impact tourism. So we'd like to see cable landings handled better, and we'd like to see the siting of these things happen in a responsible way. So I think that's an example of things that we can do right. And I think maybe we have a little bit more space to make sure that it happens the way we need it to.
Yeah, Mindy, as I said before, there's sort of the role of the government and the role of the private enterprise here. And I think Paul alluded to a flaw in the process, which was I think the government should have had a more active role in siting and in having a public discourse to decide on where these things should be onshored. Mm-hmm. And that would allow for the development offshore. One of the problems is that it was sort of left up to the wind developers to work with the towns to try to determine where these things should come onshore instead of a broader view probably handled at a state level.
Do you think there would ever be, I mean, consensus on that, though? I mean, it seems like you're never going to get everybody to agree on it. It's just like when you're talking about the tourism, there are people who would say that it would draw tourists, right? Mm-hmm. And others who say it would detract. So, I mean, it's really hard to get consensus on anything.
It is, especially on the tourism side. That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, when you drive over the bridges now, the first thing you see are big wind turbines, right? And so that certainly hasn't hurt tourism and, you know, and an unrelated topic, sharks were sort of similar. Were sharks going to hurt tourism or not? And they really haven't sort of impacted that either. I think the more important question is how does the development of offshore wind impact communities? And that's where I think we can really see some more improvement. Dan and I and the rest of the collaborative have discussed this issue of community host agreements. And so I think if you want communities to be partner, they really have to see themselves as benefiting from this. And spreading the wealth.
Yeah.
You know, any NIMBY issue is going to be controlled by a handful of people. We have to engage the entire community in the discussion.
Got to go back to the sharks for a second. Who saw that coming, right?
Yeah,
you would have thought
exactly.
That would have the complete opposite effect. You just never know.
No, now shark tourism is big.
It's huge.
Yeah, and the pool industry has exploded on the Cape. So,
yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that the collaborative has always said since our inception is that if Cape Cod can be a leader in how we manage climate change, both on the mitigation side, but also the resilience and adaptation side, we can become a destination for how communities come together to deal with climate change and actually be an example. There's an island in Denmark, Samsø Island, which 25 years ago committed itself to become completely energy self-sufficient and really be a leader in this. And now it's become a eco-energy tourism destination. And there's a way that Cape Cod could position our tourism to be around a forward-looking view of climate change instead of sort of a victim of it.
All right. We've talked before about improving EV charging stations on Cape roadways and in Cape towns. How is the regional infrastructure project coming along?
You know, it continues to move along more slowly than we would like. But the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce and the Cape Cod Commission actually have a project now called Rest and Recharge. And so part of this is to get electric vehicle recharging stations installed at hotels. We have almost 190 hotels on the Cape, and we're lagging behind the rest of the state and the rest of the region in the number of those hotels that have EV charging stations associated with them. So I think that will help. I think we're also discussing maybe approaching or developing a model bylaw for towns. So, I mean, we have so many short-term rentals now, 19,000 short-term rentals. So the Cape has half the short-term rentals in the state. almost twice as much as Boston, more than New York City. So through the local registration process, the town should require anyone that's renting a home as a short-term rental to have at least a level two charger available, because we know most of the charging is going to happen at home or wherever you're staying at night.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, you know, if you're visiting the Cape and you're looking for these charging stations, is there something available maybe through the chamber that shows you where, you know, like you're playing, I like go to the National Seashore and then I'd like to go over and, you know, you got to charge somewhere.
Yeah, there are a couple of options out there. I believe the commission has the location of EV charging stations. Some of it is, you know, it changes pretty quickly. The technology changes around that. So that I think is readily available. But so much of that information is coming through the EV car manufacturers now, so that it just pops up. We drove here from Barnstable and danced a Tesla this morning.
No, don't advertise the brand. We came here in
electric vehicle.
Yeah. And it's amazing the kind of information. Yeah. So the manufacturers of these electric vehicles are really looking out for their consumers as it relates to the proximity of charging stations.
Right. Yeah. Any electric car comes with maps that show you where and what, you know, level two, level
And they
three.
Keep up with the new ones as they come on.
Oh, yeah. 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 All of these are now, my car, for example, anytime there's an update, it automatically updates the software in the car. And most of the cars have that. The technologies are just remarkable.
Yeah. Wow. All right. So the Cape Cod Commission has been working closely with Cape Towns and the Martha's Vineyard Commission, doing similar work on the vineyard to create climate action plans. Talk about this collaboration between the commission and municipalities.
Yeah. Well, the collaborative was the recipient of a $100,000 grant from the Barr Foundation. And a big chunk of that had to do with climate adaptation and readiness from the municipalities. And the Cape Cod Commission has done so much work on that to date. So their climate action plan was really a great baseline to start to build these municipal plans off of. And the commission itself really has developed an expertise in sort of community engagement and understanding the towns. So they're moving along. And I think in Eastham, they're pretty far down the road on this. So we're hopeful that we'll start to see these municipal climate action plans popping up over the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, Chatham is way ahead also. I mean, there are some towns that are sort of taking a lead in this. And again, that's really been engagement a lot with the collaborative initially, and now, as Paul said, with the commission's climate action plan. So there's good regional planning and there's good town engagement.
Right. Okay. We look at questions about anything regional. Cape Cod Commission, they're just full of information, right? And they work so closely with the towns. So much going on.
No, they are. And I mean, the commission is the regional planning agency, but they've really carved out an important role as an information agency.
Yeah. So are there specific projects that have come out of this municipal's climate action plans that you want to highlight?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with protecting critical public resources that are at risk because they are in low-lying areas that flood, slosh zones, things like that. That's all going to come out if there is a Category 5 or even a lesser hurricane. That's going to come at huge expense to the communities, and so it's really taxpayers that are going to pick up the cost there.
Yeah. Category 5, even Category 1. Yep. I mean, think back, Hurricane Bob in 1991 was barely a Category 1. How much building have we done since that along the shore? Even a Category 1 is not going to be pretty.
No, it's not. It's not going to be pretty at all. And, you know, that sort of raises another issue I think that we've been dealing with is homeowners insurance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in 2023 on Martha's Vineyard, more than one out of every 10 homeowners that had insurance lost it.
Right.
And the vineyard in Dukes County in that December report were counties that had 10,000 or fewer homeowners insurance policies. If you look at counties that have 10,000 or more, Barnstable County ranks third in the nation behind two fire-average counties in California. So it's a significant threat, and it's one of the areas where climate change is impacting ordinary people right now.
Right, yeah. We've talked a lot about that the home insurance costs in our region spiking, you know, in the news. And, you know, the Martha's Vineyard Times did a nice job. We did a collaboration with that. And it was just shocking to hear some of the people's stories of, you know, not being able to afford the insurance.
Well, exactly. I mean, you have school teachers that lose homeowners insurance and can't afford to self-insure. They're going to sell to people with disposable income. But it raises the question, are those people with disposable income, is this their third or fourth home? What happens if the storm does hit and they have to rebuild? Will they rebuild? Mm-hmm. Or are we becoming disposable as a region?
Yeah, boy, good question. So what are we doing regionally to help people with homeowners insurance?
Well, what we'd like to do at the Collaborative is engage a discussion on potentially creating a catastrophic insurance fund to sort of underwrite some of this, to keep insurers on the Cape and keep homeowners insurance affordable. Yeah. It's a big topic. It's a big discussion. But I think these are the kind of things that we can do now at the Collaborative. I mean, it's really about looking inward, looking locally. What is it that we can do here now while we wait for federal policy to change?
Yeah. And I mean, just thinking, you know, some of these, we hear these stories about some of the houses that are, you know, right on the, you know, erosion areas, like on Nantucket, a house that sells for $600,000 because you're only going to get a season out of it. And we're seeing more and more of that. And I can't imagine that these houses are insured, are they?
No, a lot of them are self-insured. I think the according to the report, only 65% of the homes on the Cape were insured.
Wow.
Had insurance, you know, and that's amazing. But it's also should raise a huge red flag for the towns, because if you look at the amount of property tax that they raise that comes from the coastal properties, I mean, once the property values drop or those properties go away, it's going to impact these municipal budgets. And that property tax burden is just going to shift onto those who can least afford it.
Yeah. And the other thing is those who have homeowners insurance are very often underinsured, mm-hmm. because if you have a mortgage, the bank or whoever holds a mortgage requires that you have insurance, but only up to the level of their mortgage. So yeah. if you have $1 million property and a $200,000 mortgage, you might only have $200,000 of homeowners insurance.
Good point. And with the cost of everything going up, right? I mean,
well, there's a lot been written, Mindy, lately about the impact of tariffs,
right.
because a lot of our building materials come from Canada. And they're talking about an 8 to 10% increase in homeowners insurance rates just because of the cost of rebuilding the home.
Yeah. I'm just even thinking of my own homeowners insurance, where my wind deductible was something like a couple $1,000s. It's a lot more than that now, right? It gets continually goes up and up and up to a point you go, yeah, it's crazy. All right. Funding for climate adaptation, resiliency, or even retreat is always an issue. Do municipalities get federal dollars for some of these projects? And if so, are those dollars or grants at risk?
Yeah, I think the federal grants are at risk that have come through that. There are some state resources as well, but I think even today there was an executive order signed yesterday that seeks to penalize states that are actively engaged in climate change and providing those funds. So once again, I think we're going to see some of those funds dry up. And but I think we are seeing with some of the larger private foundations reorganization of their own resources and deploying those resources in a way to backstop some of what is this clear retreat from the federal government and the state government from funding those kind of efforts.
Yeah, without regard to short term, you know, this current administration will be there for 3 more years, but this is a long term situation that we're dealing with. And a lot of what you're talking about, Mindy, is infrastructure improvements to buttress and to be resilient and adapt our environment around climate change. So when you're looking at utility lines that are going to need to be fortified, undergrounded, or you know, in some cases just fortified, you're looking at roadways and stuff that are going to have to be either raised or improved relative to climate change. We're going to need outside funding. The towns don't have the capacity to pay for the adaptation that needs to happen. So it's either going to have to come from a state or a federal level. I don't think that's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years from a federal perspective, but we have to be planning for the long term on this, and we have to be looking past this 3 years. Climate change is a scientific fact, but it's a scientific fact that is denied on a federal level by this administration. So as much as we want to depoliticize it, we're not actually the ones politicizing it.
All right. We're talking about regional efforts to address climate change this hour. What are you doing at home or in your community to make a difference? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about regional efforts to address climate change, and we have two folks from the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative, Dan Wolf, Government Affairs Committee Chair, and Paul Nizwicki, Nominating Committee Chair. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in, if you have a question or a thought. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. just looking at, you know, adaptation to, like, there's so many areas now that we have, what do you call those, sunny day flooding, and there's no storm, and we're seeing a lot of that, I think, on Nantucket. And the thing with Nantucket, where you have all of those historic buildings, right, and the, you know, water kind of creeping up there, adaptation is, that's a difficult area when you're looking at historic buildings, isn't it?
It is, and I think one of the areas that we see it a lot is Commercial Street in Provincetown, for example.
Another one, yeah.
Which floods on a regular basis now. And if you look at Provincetown as a town, that's their whole commercial district. That's where all the commerce happens. But if you look at a town like Yarmouth as well, like, most of their commercial district is really on the South Shore, which is in a huge slosh zone. So, yeah, when you look at it from an economic perspective, you know, a lot of our economic activities are located in very high-risk areas.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine that Provincetown, and Paul, I think you nailed it, it's a town on the Cape where the commercial district is in that most vulnerable area. It's hard to imagine that in 10 or 20 or 30 years, Provincetown won't be requiring a seawall of some kind to actually control the water flow, because sea level rise, Mindy, in our lifetime has gone up a lot more than we thought. And as you said, and even in an astronomical high tide now, mm-hmm. if you have any wind or any agitation, the water is inundating.
Yeah, I just think of even Surf Drive here in Falmouth, which is a little, in 1991 when I got married, we actually had a beach party on Surf Drive. I look at it now and I'm like, there's no way, right? It's like, so that's really a short amount of time when you think of how much that has the tide has risen.
And it's accelerating now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And you have areas like that, and there are many along that flood, you know, and you have to think, is this a road we want to keep, right? Or is this something? And then that opens a whole nother can of worms, because anybody who has houses or property there, they're going to say, no, we need to keep fixing it. So what about those discussions on what areas you have to give up on, give to Mother Nature, so to speak?
Well, I think those discussions are being had now. And the Cape Cod Commission has done a great report on low-lying roads around the Cape. You can even look at areas of the old Kings Highway in Sandwich that are barely above water now. And so any sort of engineering solution to that is going to be really costly. So not doing it has to be one of the other options that's on the table. And those are going to be very difficult discussions to have. And I think we would benefit as a region by having those discussions collectively about the entire coast. And so, you know, maybe the commission considers a district a critical planning concern for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. And as you know, I mean, now the word retreat has sort of been introduced into the vocabulary. Right. So it's adaptation, resilience, and retreat, because there are areas coupled with sea level rise that where erosion is a real problem now. Mm-hmm. And where the only option is going to be to retreat and fortify.
Yeah. And retreat is such, I mean, it's so emotional for people, especially people who've had, you know, this family home, you know, for generation after generation. And, you know, logically, you know, you can't fight Mother Nature, right? But then there's that emotion of giving that up. You see where people kind of want to hang on as long as possible.
Absolutely. I think we saw that several years ago in Chatham.
Right.
You know, with the homes that were basically on stilts and no electricity, but they've been in the family. They did not want to give those up.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about some of the things people can be doing at home. Do we still have programs to encourage people to install solar or to make the switch to electric heat pumps for heating and cooling? Is that still happening?
Yeah. Cape Lake Compact is really a state and I would say national leader as far as working with homeowners and residents to look at what opportunities they have to both make homes more energy efficient, but also to introduce new technologies. So solar storage is now on the table. So yeah, there's a lot of resources out there, and the listeners should contact Cape Lake Compact because they really run some great programs here on the Cape.
Mm-hmm. And solar, just, you know, everybody probably has people knocking on their doors, right, with all these trying to sell solar. You want to be careful, right? You want to really do your homework before you sign on for any solar instant and really look at that leasing versus buying, right? So give us some thoughts for homeowners who are thinking about that, what they should be thinking.
Again, I would go to Cape Lake Compact because they have a list of really good sort of, and you're right, there's a lot of, not scam, but a lot of subpar installers out there. But I think if you deal with a legitimate agency like Cape Light, they can actually direct you towards credible installers and folks to work with.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. What else can we be doing? What are we hoping that people can be? Because as Madison said early on, there's this burnout, right, where you go, oh, this is just so overwhelming and it's so serious and it's It's hard to think about, but and you feel helpless. So what can the average person be? What are some of the things the average person can be doing?
Mindy, I'm going to put on my former state senate hat.
Go ahead.
And while important action is really critical, that people look at their own personal situation and say, what can I do relative to the energy use in my home and how can I be a better citizen relative to climate change? One of the things citizens need to be doing now is pushing hard to policymakers to make sure that the state and their local communities' leaders are doing everything they can as far as adopting policies and regulations to address this. Unfortunately, you know, we're in this country 4% of the world's population using 40% of the world's resources, and we need to be a global leader in mitigation and adaptation and resilience. And right now, that's sort of stalled, but there's still a lot that can be done politically and from a policy perspective at a local and state level. And I would just encourage people to stay engaged. Don't get overwhelmed or burnt out by it that you give up, but just know where your energies can be appropriately directed now, where they're going to make a difference. I don't think calling the White House right now is going to help on climate change, but I do think being engaged on a state and local level can make a big difference.
Yeah, I think we all understand the importance of personal responsibility and what we do in our own households as it relates to impacting climate change. But I think now is the time for people to get engaged and to come together with other like-minded people, because there are issues, whether it's homeowners insurance, on the Cape, or the readiness of the grid, or whatever your town is doing as it relates to properties that are at risk or public resources that are at risk. Those are things you can engage on now in these communities. And that's what we really need to do. We need to get out of our homes and engage with the larger community on this issue, because there are things we can do locally that have to be done.
Yeah, can I give you an example?
Yeah, sure.
I was in New Orleans, Louisiana last week. And it's a beautiful place, stayed in the French Quarter. And I was walking around the French Quarter three mornings ago thinking one of the reasons that this place is so special is it's a historic district and I don't see a single power line. Mm-hmm. And a number of years ago, the city of New Orleans said, let's put them underground for two reasons. One, the aesthetics. It is a tourist destination. And the other is it actually shelters it from the impacts of weather. And that's a very weather-prone area, just like we are here on the Cape. I go around Provincetown or Chatham or Falmouth or any of our beautiful village centers, and I ask myself, why do we still have power lines that are, you know, just they're aesthetically kind of offensive, although some people think they're artistic, I don't, and they're very vulnerable. And if you look at, for example, that stretch of road along Route 6 between Truro and Provincetown, why are those power lines? I mean, half the poles are like leaning over the road. Mm-hmm. So I just don't get it. That's not going to be an individual thing. Yeah. That's going to be, we have to put pressure on folks to make sure it gets done.
Well, and it's a cost thing, right? I mean, we can't put them underground. But I would wonder, what is the cost of maintaining all of that and those leaning poles versus what it would cost to put them underground?
Yeah, well, it is costly when you talk to the utilities about doing that. And they'll say, you know, they're trying to keep rates low, and this would add to sort of the rate base. But it's also cost on not just for the utilities to bury the poles, but then for businesses and homeowners to kind of redo the how they receive that electricity into the properties. And so that comes at an expense, too. And I know that shut down the discussion in Main Street Hyannis decades ago. Yeah. The utility agreed to do it, but the businesses couldn't afford the cost of preparing themselves to take that not off the pole, but from the ground.
Right. Let's talk to Christy, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Christy.
Hi there. I went solar about a year and a half ago, and we were offered a prepaid power purchase agreement, a 25-year prepaid power purchase agreement. I wound up leasing the equipment, but doing this 25-year prepaid power purchase agreement. So they showed me one of those tables, you know, that shows you lock in the current rate, and over the course of years, you know, the cost may go up, but you're not, your cost doesn't go up, but then the efficiency goes down, and somewhere like 20 years from now, it winds up not, you know, working in my favor. So it seemed okay, but the sales rep told me it was the first time he had done one of these agreements, which is why I'm not going to say who did this, I don't think they thought it through. I definitely don't think they explained it carefully, because I paid for 25 years of power in advance, but I had to continue paying electric bills because I didn't have enough credit because we installed the panels in the winter or in the fall. And so it seemed like a good idea, but I think it wasn't fully thought out. No. If it's going to happen, there should be a mechanism for, you know, I thought I wouldn't have to pay anything else.
Right.
And we wound up continuing to pay electric bills.
Yeah.
So I just want to, you know, advise people who are considering the prepaid power purchase agreement to ask more questions than I did.
Do your homework. Christy, thank you for sharing that. That's kind of what I was alluding to, Dan, when I was saying you want to do your research, right?
You need to do your research. I'm not a huge fan of power purchase agreements as it relates to home solar. Some of our local banks actually offer financing to install a solar system. And the beauty of that is if you finance it correctly over the right number of years and amortize it correctly, the system can get paid for by what you're saving in utility bills. So I would really encourage people to make sure they sharpen the pencil, work with someone, again, like at Cape Light Compact, who is an objective source of information that can help them work through the business side of this. Because the technical side is one thing, and we all love that and can support it, but the business structure, you know, how you put it on your house, how you pay for it,
right,
and how it amortizes over a number of years is really critical to get it done.
It gets confusing. Yeah, I mean, for sure.
Yeah, it's very confusing. I think it's another example of where the industry is new. So we have to be careful if there are people that are trying to take advantage of consumers, consumer dissatisfaction, or community dissatisfaction. That becomes a drag on getting these projects done. And we can't afford to have that kind of drag when we're dealing with the political headwinds that we are, that are clearly being driven by fossil fuel and coal companies.
Do you think that the incentive to put solar on is under this administration? Are we seeing changes there?
You mean on a federal level or state?
Yeah,
State incentives are there.
They're still there. Yeah.
And actually, the market works. If you do a solar right, the payback you get through the solar generation will actually cover the cost of the installation over time. I think we have to get much more creative on the economics of it so that we can make it seamless. Mm-hmm. If you're paying a $300 or $400 a month bill for electricity, and you can amortize and finance a project such that $400 is now going to paying for a solar project, that you're basically just cost shifting. You're not really incurring an additional expense.
And who knows what's going to happen to the price of electricity in the future, right?
It's unbelievably expensive here on the Cape. Yeah. I mean, right now, I think we're between 33 and 35 cents a kilowatt hour. But down in New Orleans, where I just was, it was like half of that.
Wow.
So that is something that has to be addressed going forward, because it's a huge drag on the home economics.
Yeah, for sure. Richard in Falmouth writes, in an effort to reduce our carbon footprint, we bought a smaller house, removed propane heat, relying on heat pumps for cooling and heating, added insulation, and installing solar panels in the near future, hoping to get our house as neutral as possible.
Neutral, and also financially, it's going to work in his favor, I'm
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think a lot of folks would like to do that. But again, it costs money, right? It costs money to make all these changes. So for those who are going, I'd like to do that, but I don't have the money, what are some of the things they can do?
Well, I mean, they can reach out. Cape Light Compact is one of the areas that I would reach out to for programs that look at how to finance some of these sustainable options.
And some of the insulating and energy resources are free.
I was just going to say that. We did this years ago through Cape Light Compact. We called and they come out and they do an assessment. And they gave you, but it didn't cost much because they had some kind of a program that offset the price. And it was amazing. And I know there's sometimes a long list of get on now for next.
Well, Mindy, way back I was in the aviation business. We had a huge hangar at the airport in Hyannis, and Cape Light Compact came in and did insulation. They changed our bulbs into low energy lighting systems and put in tens of thousands of dollars, but reduced our energy consumption by $30,000 or $40,000 a year, believe it or not. So there are some big things that you can do that make a big difference.
And so what are you hoping people will do at the community level to support climate forward policies and action? You sort of touched on that, Dan. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've got to organize and they've got to look. Every town is dealing with the issue from an adaptation level, at least. So show up and start to make sure that these hyper-local policy decision-making boards, like boards of selectmen, are doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. And what about education? Thoughts on education? Because I think that, you know, it's a lot of people aren't even aware of some of these issues, right? So how do you educate yourself on that?
I think there are a lot of resources out there to educate yourself on what's up there. But there's the more that one of the problems I have, and Dan and I have discussed this, is so much of the industry is driven by the private sector for profit that, you know, you really got to be careful. It's a buyer beware situation mm-hmm. out there. But websites like the Cape Cod Commission's website and others are good places to start for information. And I think we've got some great regional organizations here on the Cape that can serve as sort of clearinghouses for really good, solid information, fact-based, data-driven decisions can be made from it.
So look at the Cape Cod Climate Collaborative website. Mm-hmm. We have all of our newsletters archived there. It is a tremendous resource. The Climate Change Collaborative for the last 8 years now, time is flying, has done our annual event, which is all about educating our community.
And when is that?
We're going to have another one coming up, Paul, this fall.
Yes.
Mindy, as you know, the collaborative is becoming more engaged with the Cape Cod Chamber. Mm-hmm. So over time, you're going to see more and more on the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce website, right, Paul?
Yeah.
I would imagine. But for now, everybody listening should go online right now and look at the Cape Cod Climate Collaborative website. There is a ton of information there, not only about what we've done, but about what people can do at an individual level and as a community.
I want to touch on something, Dan, you talked about before we went on the air. And with everything that's happening, all the chaos around us, this focus on climate change, you were talking about being at one of the rallies in New Orleans.
Yep.
And not a lot of signs, but nothing that said
I saw
climate
signs
change.
About Social Security and Medicaid and immigration.
And all good topics.
And, yeah. You know, 2 years ago, Mindy, if you went to a rally, you would always see climate change as the existential issue of our time. And one of my concerns is that right now it seems to have taken a backseat to a lot of issues. And the problem is climate change isn't going to wait for the next administration. Mm-hmm. So we've got to continue to push it forward as the existential issue of our time, because I believe it is.
Got just about a minute or so left. Closing thoughts, Paul, you want to start?
Well, you know, I think those people that care about climate change, that know about climate change, might be somewhat discouraged by what's happening on the federal level and the corresponding financial impact at the state level. So it's time to look locally now. It's time to act locally. And I think we're well positioned on the Cape to do that and to be a leader in sort of climate change action moving forward.
And feel like you're accomplishing something, right? Dan, final thoughts?
Yeah, well, we can be a beacon to the world. We have millions of visitors that come here. And I think if they see us behaving responsibly relative to this issue, they will take that home with them. And so I see this as an opportunity for our region, not only to address climate change, but to be a beacon for the rest of the world. And we should stay focused on that in spite of some of the distractions that we are seeing on a day-to-day basis now, Mindy.
All right. And we're going to post links with more information about the collaborative and the Global Fight for Climate Action Rally, which is taking place tomorrow at 11 at the Bourne Bridge. As Madison said, bring your sign. Dan, maybe you'll see some of the climate change signs you want to see.
That will be an exciting event.
And we'll have links with that at our website, capeandislands.org. Dan Wolf, Paul Nidzwicki, as always, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.